Thanks for listening to the Not a Diving podcast. For bonus episodes, early access, ad-free listening, and access to our private Discord server, sign up at patreon.com/scubaofficial.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
This is not a diving podcast, but Scuba.
Welcome to the show. I'm Scuba. This is the Not a Diving podcast. Hello from Delhi, India. I've been in the subcontinent, on the subcontinent, for the last week. I think I mentioned last week that all my shows have been cancelled. Anyway, if I didn't, then all my shows have been cancelled. So I've basically been on holiday for the last week. I've been in Jodhpur in Rajasthan and for the last couple of days in Delhi. And I'm flying today to Tokyo to play at Vent this Friday. And then on Saturday, I'm playing my first ever show in Shanghai. So fun stuff. I've had a nice week, been eating a lot of Indian food, drinking quite a lot of Indian beer, and have put on a little bit of weight as a result. But, you know, what can you do? Embrace the touring lifestyle when you have the opportunity. I very rarely do this stuff anymore, but, you know, nice to get out on the road and have new experiences, which is exactly what I've been doing over the last week. Anyway, I'm going to keep this short because I think the sound quality on this is going to be bad. I'm in a hotel room talking to a pretty dodgy mic. So let's just get through this, shall we? On the show this week, we welcome Chloe Kaye. Chloe is an extremely successful DJ these days. She's really broken through in the last couple of years, principally as a result, I think it's fair to say, of Circa Loco in Ibiza and her residency there. But as we discover in the conversation, there's a whole lot more to her than that too. And I think pigeonholing her as an Ibiza DJ is definitely unfair. So I don't know why I've just done that, but let's just like rewind that and just say she's a successful DJ and musician. She's got a really interesting backstory. She's a real music person from formative experiences in Paris and Bristol through to New York City. And on the circuit in the last few years, really, as I said, just breaking through and making waves with DJ sets and productions. So Chloe's a really thoughtful, interesting person. It was great to catch up with her. We hadn't met before this conversation. So this is the kind of thing that I really enjoy doing on this show. It's an opportunity to connect with people who I haven't done before and shoot the shit, basically, which is what we do over the course of a bit over an hour. So it's a good one. You're going to enjoy it. I'm going to shut up and get to the airport to catch my flight to Tokyo. Without further delay, here is Chloe Kaye. Chloe Kaye, welcome to the show. How's it going?
I'm doing good, actually. Finally home after a pretty long couple months of touring, so I couldn't be happier.
Okay, where is home for you?
I live between Ibiza and Miami.
Oh, right. Okay. So where now, exactly?
Right now I'm in Ibiza.
Right.
Sunny Island.
Yeah, absolutely. I actually live in Palma, so not very far away.
Oh, no way. We're just like a little ferry ride away.
Exactly. How long have you been in Ibiza for?
I've been here. I sort of came during the pandemic at some point to write some music, and then I kind of decided to make this one of my homes. Because I just kind of fell in love with the island. I've been here for about 3 years on and off.
Mm. How have you found living there? I mean, it's one thing going, you know, to visit and to play and whatever, but from my conversations with other people, it can be a slightly different thing actually being there the whole time.
Yeah, I mean, I think when you live here, you tend to settle in as more of a local, so you don't really partake in as much of the party scene. You know, I definitely play a lot of venues here, but I tend to stay a little bit more chill. I have my studio here, my dog. So, you know, a lot of my time here is spent actually just at home or kind of enjoying the nature side of the island.
Had you spent much time prior to, you know, coming over during the pandemic?
I mean, I'd been playing here for about 3 years beforehand, just kind of coming in the summers. And then I'd come a couple times in the winter with my mom, just to kind of do some more of the retreat side of stuff here. But I'd never actually, you know, thought of living here ever until the world shut down. And I was like, well, there's nothing else to do.
Right.
Kind of forced me to slow down, which was nice.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, you're commonly written up as being an Ibiza DJ. Is that something you're happy with or something you are frustrated with? Or like, because that's certainly, it's in the first line of pretty much every biography that you come across for you.
I mean, it's a bit weird because I'm definitely not an Ibiza DJ. You know, I definitely have a residency here, but I'm not an Ibiza born and raised DJ. Like, I'm from New York. And I actually started my roots in DJing was actually in New York City, and most of my career was spent out of Ibiza. So I do think it's a bit funny, but I guess people need something to kind of hold on to. And because of my affiliation with Circo Loco, I think it's easy for people to just box me in as like, okay, Circo Loco, Ibiza. Okay. That makes sense.
Yeah, no, absolutely. People always want to have a box to put someone in, don't they?
Yeah, always. That's a real thing in the industry.
Yeah, totally. So when did you start playing for Circo?
I started playing for them. So I played my first time was when they did that mini reopening right after the pandemic in October. So that was 2021 or 2020. No, 2021.
Yeah, that sounds right.
Yeah, I'm confused with the years now. But yeah, it was October 2021 was my first gig with them. And then we actually were discussing at that point about, you know, kind of coming in together on a bigger partnership with releasing of music. And yeah, that was the first summer after that was when I kind of locked into my first sort of residency with them. And then where I started playing a lot of their outside shows. So outside of Ibiza.
Yeah, it's pretty impressive how they've managed to build it out into what I guess it's a kind of global brand at this point, isn't it? Because obviously it was so integral to Ibiza for so long, but also, you know, very, very much associated with that. But now it's something quite a lot more, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing what they've been able to build because, you know, it's one of the few, I'd say, party brands, well, you know, clubs, DC10 in itself, but that's always kind of been run in a family style. You know, at least in Ibiza, like they've never brought in different owners. They've never brought in a bigger investor. You know, they've kept it really, really run by themselves and by their core community. And I think that's why it's been so successful over the years. And that's why I think now bringing it abroad for them has also been so successful because they've never really sold out, if that makes sense. You know, they've kind of always kept it true to what they wanted to do. And I just think whenever I play these parties, people love it. You know, they come from all over the world. They come early and it's crazy the amount of sort of fan base that Circo Loco has now globally.
Yeah. It's interesting, actually. What have the other parties been like? I mean, obviously I've been to Circo many times. I've actually played there a few times too, but only at DC10. And it can be difficult, I think, to sort of transplant the vibe of a party to a kind of what is basically a touring event. It can be difficult, I think, for promoters. And I think that also for DJs playing there. So what have your experiences been of playing their other events?
I mean, I think every country and every city that you play in has its own vibe, right? So like obviously Ibiza in the summer on Mondays is a very, very specific vibe. And, you know, when you play inside DC10, it's just got this extremely sort of familial, like just fun. It's just a real party, you know, people go there to party, they go there to dance. Like it's just a proper good party. And I think it brings together people from all over the world. You know, Ibiza is a very, I'd say, like global kind of destination that you really get a pretty good mixture of people from everywhere and as well as locals, which is really nice. And I think that, you know, when you start touring around the world, I'd say Circo Loco always has a pretty global audience. You know, wherever they kind of go, they do tend to attract locals. They do tend to attract people that are visiting, people fly in for the party. And I would say the vibe isn't really that different. It obviously depends in which city. But for example, when I play in Circo Loco in New York, it's just a proper party and people are just, you know, all ready for Halloween and it's a great time. Similar to, I'm trying to think where else I've played Circo Loco. My brain is not remembering right now, but you know, I just feel like it's generally a party that attracts people that want to have a good time, I would say.
I mean, certainly your description of the Monday night Ibiza is, yeah, absolutely as I remember it being. I actually I didn't go last summer, but yeah, it definitely is fun. Okay, what's your kind of musical approach to playing? Now, I'm just going to stick on Circo Loco for a moment. I've got lots of other questions as well too, but just to finish up on this. What's your musical approach to playing there? Because particularly in Ibiza, it's what I really like about it is that it's quite varied musically, and you can actually get away with playing techno and doing stuff which is more difficult in other parties on the island, right? That's kind of what I like about it the most, I think, is that actually you have a quite high degree of freedom playing there musically.
Yeah, I mean, I think one thing that's amazing about Circo Loco is that, you know, the team over there has really done a great job at consistently bringing in, you know, a series of, I'd say, like more resident artists that you kind of know the sound, you know where they're going to go. And then they also bring in a lot of different kinds of artists that are either up and coming legendary acts or artists that have different sounds. Like they don't book just one genre, one room, one lineup. You know, they really allow for eclectic lineups. So I think as an artist that, you know, for me, for example, I do play there quite often and I get excited every time I play because I kind of want to do things, maybe go a little bit of a different direction every set and like bring it here and then bring it there. And there's definitely a freedom in sound because, you know, as I mentioned, like I just feel like it's a party. So as long as you're getting people kind of going and dancing, I think anything kind of goes there. I've seen some incredible artists play everything from more, I'd say, groovier, slower house to a lot more high energy, faster sort of techno leaning sets to everything in the middle, you know? And I just feel like if you get the people going, you have the energy behind the booth and you kind of have the consistent groove, which I think is kind of true to Circo Loco, is like always maintaining a groove. I just feel like people are really, really receptive, which is amazing, especially in Ibiza where we're seeing a lot less, I'd say, eclectic lineups over the years, I would say.
Yeah. Yeah, I totally agree with you. Okay, so I had a couple of general questions about Ibiza then, just to, yeah, as I said, to finish up this bit. But how much partying did you do there before you played there, if any?
Oh my God, a lot. Listen, my first residency here was actually with Dixon for Transmoderna at Pasha. And I actually moved out here for the summer and I was here for 4 months. And I think I've never partied so much in my life.
That sounds intense, right?
Like, I think I was out every single night, about like 6-7 nights a week for months and months. And it just was this routine of like, you know, because I was new to the island. So I really wanted to, you know, kind of soak it in and see what was going on. And I was everywhere. It was amazing, but it was exhausting. And I think come October after our closing, where we played this incredible sort of long set at the Cave, I just completely crashed and I needed like a minute to kind of like realize what just happened because I did not rest one second. And it was a lot of information, a lot of partying, a lot of people, a lot of fun. I learned a lot. You know, I dove in pretty much in the deep end.
Yeah. Awesome. You kind of touched on the, how should I put this, commercial forces that can affect bookings in Ibiza and just the whole scene there. Like, I mean, ever since I've been going there, which is, I don't know, well, how long, 10 years or so, a bit more than 10 years, there always seems to be this kind of conflict between big money and people who are serious, in quotation marks, about music, right? And there are absolutely those people. And, you know, obviously Circo Loco are amongst those people, but there are more people like that too. So what's been your observation of how those two things interact with each other? I mean, you mentioned before how lineups are consolidating, maybe. What's your general thoughts on that stuff?
I mean, I think that, so I think post-pandemic, right, we saw a lot of fear in clubs and in venues that obviously suffered tremendously financially during the pandemic. And I think that clubs were no longer willing to take risks with bookings. And I think that especially in Ibiza, where your cost of operations and your cost of runnings are extremely high, you know, there's, you need to, you know, to be safe, you know, to rely on certain artists that do sell the certain amount of tickets that you need. And as Ibiza has kind of moved to, I'd say, more of a table VIP format, where I'd say most clubs in Ibiza make their money from table sales and from the sort of VIP element now that is a thing here. You know, they need to bring certain DJs that they know have the VIP crowd that sell the tickets and that also play the music that people are going to, you know, keep coming back for. And so I think because of that transition over the years, and I think because of the pandemic and this sort of fear of, like, I'd say financial fear, I think a lot of venues have kind of trimmed down a lot who they want to book and how they want to operate their residencies to ensure a constant success, you know, because taking risks is no longer something that I think a lot of promoters are willing to do, at least what I've seen. Which is why I think, you know, Circo Loco has done such an amazing job, because they have taken risks. You know, they have booked artists that are extremely on the up and coming side. You know, they put me in there as a new resident. And, you know, those are risks. Those are like, okay, well, Chloe's a new artist. She doesn't sell tickets now, but we're going to build her up and we're going to believe in her long term. And I just think that there's kind of a little bit of a lack of that in other venues. And I just think it's primarily down to what I mentioned, you know, the VIP crowd today being its sort of primary thing in Ibiza, and this sort of fear of, yeah, of not hitting the numbers. And it's a shame, because I think Ibiza does, you know, for certain artists that do lock into certain residencies, that it can really propulse you into other places in the world. And people do look at Ibiza, you know, promoters do see what people are doing here. And it's a really important market to kind of have a solid base in, I would say.
Yeah, the kind of move towards, I guess it's higher end tourism, like higher value in quotation marks tourism, is something which has been, I think it's come down from the government in the Balearics, hasn't it? I mean, it's certainly something that they've tried to do. They've been later to the party, as it were, at it in Mallorca, as I said, where I live. But you can really see it now that they're trying to squeeze out the kind of package tourism, and, you know, places like Magaluf, they've made a big effort to change the kind of people who are coming in. And obviously that has real implications for nightlife and what's happened to Ibiza gradually over time. But I think maybe, yeah, you're right to say that it's accelerated since the pandemic is really a reflection of that. I think, yeah, it's, I mean, true. I mean, sorry, go on.
Yeah. I mean, no, I mean, I was just going to say, for sure, like, Ibiza has gotten so expensive, you know, since
the pandemic. It's crazy. Yeah.
And, you know, just to be able to come here on holiday as, like, a young raver that wants to go out and club, or, you know, go raving, like, they're spending thousands of pounds. And you know, it's between your accommodation, you know, your drinks, your transportation, your flights, your tickets, entrances, like, everything is so expensive that I think it's actually, you know, pushed the needle on a certain type of raver. And I think that a lot of my friends, for example, the only reason why they come out is because they've got a place to stay. You know, we invite them out. They want to come see their friends play. But that's a more of a niche audience today. And so I think that, you know, as you said, also Ibiza, you know, they really wanted to kind of put more restrictions on nightlife. Like, today, throwing any kind of house party is quite complicated, you know. And I think they want to, Ibiza is a place that they want to kind of, as you said, just bring in the higher value tourism in these sort of expensive, you know, people that rent expensive villas and this stuff versus just the young raver that was probably more about in like the 90s, early 2000s, which is a bit sad. But, you know, I understand that after the pandemic, changes wanted to be made by the government.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's the thing. I think it is at a certain level totally understandable that they would want to do that, because at the end of the day, there's a certain type of tourism which is just not great at all for the people who live in that area, you know. I mean, it really is bad, and you can understand why they might want to dampen that down a little bit. But I mean, just moving out to outside Ibiza, because the kinds of forces that you are referring to that have affected venues, I mean, that's true everywhere. We've talked quite a bit on the show previously to this about how small venues in particular have really been squeezed. Is that something that you've noticed in your touring in the last couple of years?
I mean, 100%. I think that, I mean, for me, one thing I've noticed over the last few years is that there's been an incredible rise of just a lot of artists, you know, from every genre, everywhere, that I'm just seeing across the board. And what I am seeing is that you've got this sort of underground space where you've got all these incredible artists that kind of live in and play in these smaller rooms. But then as soon as you kind of reach a sort of mid-sized, bigger room, you tend to see a lot of the same bookings. And I think that, you know, it's back to what we were just saying, that, you know, mid-sized rooms really suffered a lot. And I think that, again, they need to make, you know, the ticket count, they need to make the sales. And they're not willing to take the chance on potentially giving a younger artist that might be really buzzing but might not be worth a lot of tickets the chance to kind of build with them. And you are just kind of seeing across the world, like, a lot of the similar names, a lot of the similar people just consistently touring across the same, like, I'd say, like, territories. And yeah, it's definitely been interesting to see. I mean, not to say that any of these artists are not worth the ticket sales, you know. It's amazing and it's incredible to see all of this happening. But I think it's definitely been an observation that I've been seeing from the sideline.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's striking, but maybe not that surprising, that there are relatively few acts in dance music, electronic music generally, but I think particular house and techno, specifically dance music, there are very few people who actually can sell tickets, like a meaningful amount of tickets. And I think the audience, generally speaking, tends to follow genres in dance music. So you probably say, oh, I like techno, before listing a bunch of, you know, really good producers, but like, it's more the genre that they're a fan of. But then on top of that, those very few headliners, like as you refer to, who understandably, I guess, dominate the bookings because they're the only ones who can guarantee those kinds of ticket sales. Does that resonate?
I mean, 100%. I mean, I'd say that right now, for example, like, techno is probably one of the bigger genres. You know, I'd say, like, it's crazy how many young kids are just obsessed with techno and how many viral videos are going on TikTok of just techno drops, you know. And there's just so many artists that, like, I've never even heard of that pop into my feed, and suddenly I look and they've got like a million followers and they just play this like sort of hard techno, and I'm like, what is, like, then they're popping up everywhere all over the world. It's like, and kids just want it. I feel like kids just want it faster, harder, like almost like noise. I'm like, I'm just trying to catch on to it, because I'm like, I just come from such a different sort of background that I'm just kind of stepping into it, and I'm fascinated, you know. It's like, I'm like, wow, like, it's crazy how kids' attention spans, I feel like, is just, they just want it direct, you know. And I think it's true what you're saying, that, you know, you're seeing a lot of multi-bills. We're seeing a lot of promoters put together these sort of big lineups, which, you know, will have five or six artists so they can guarantee a certain amount of ticket sales. But when you do look at like the single headline shows, like, yeah, there's a handful of artists that have managed to keep building their ticket sales over 10 plus years. And even today, like over the last 3-4 years, there's also just a handful of artists that are worth a certain amount of tickets. And, you know, I'd say DJ fees have also gotten more expensive over the last sort of 10 years. And so I think, you know, venues need to ensure, well, okay, if you're charging me, say, £5,000, like, you're worth, it's like this, the same amount of ticket sales, you know?
Yeah, that's got to be the calculation, right?
Of course. So venues are looking at their numbers and going, right, well, we can afford a little bit more on this day or not. And at the end of the day, like, you know, I think artists tend to forget that we're just products and, you know, we're just put there as like revenue streams for other people, which is amazing when you understand that. It's like, okay, it's just business and maths. Okay, cool. But now I can do my art and also have fun with it and be creative. But don't forget, you know, that like it's a numbers game. And if you start charging too much money and you're not worth the tickets, like it, at some point that doesn't work.
Yeah, you'll get found out. You'll definitely get found out.
It's obvious, you know. So I think there's definitely been a lot of readjusting. I think there's definitely been a lot of promoters making mistakes. I think there's definitely been a rise in new promoters that are doing really cool things. I think there's also just a crazy amount of parties and festivals going on. And, you know, it's just, I feel like everything's just come back more. So, you know, we're definitely at the stage now where I'm seeing things a bit filtered down. I'm seeing parties stop happening. I'm seeing things kind of level down a little bit, I would say.
Mm. Yeah. I mean, one of the things that we've actually, one of the things we talked about quite a lot around this issue is just the concept of ticketed events per se, and how actually for smaller venues in particular, and venues who are, you know, trying to support new music, you know, new acts, you know, individual local scenes, the requirement to shift hard tickets is a real problem for that kind of those objectives, you know, because it really places a kind of pressure which is, I think, difficult to bear. We've talked a lot about on previous shows, talked a lot about the development of local scenes and how they can be quite inconsistent getting started. It requires patience and it requires a bit of, you know, leeway given by venues in oftentimes. And having everything ticketed, and it is now basically, the conversation we've just been having is basically just like, you know, can you sell tickets? That's a real problem, I think, creatively.
I mean, it's a huge problem, because if you look at back in the day, like, for example, you know, legendary clubs like Paradise Garage or where, you know, the Warehouse in Chicago, you know, these venues were not reliant on who was playing. It was a general vibe that I think people bought into, and once they were there, they discovered the music and then became fans of the DJs. And DJs were never these sort of superstar on the stage with like sparkling whatever and visuals. It was just like the DJ was there to just play great records and get the people dancing. And I think that today we reverse that, where now DJs are rock stars or superstars or whatever, you know, when they're on stage and all eyes are on them. And we've shifted this model. So if a club doesn't have a sort of built-in crowd that trusts the club on bringing cool DJs, I would say there's a handful of those clubs worldwide that you would go to regularly every Friday without knowing who's playing and buy a ticket and go and just trust the promoter to book a show. Like, there just aren't that many clubs that have been able to maintain that over the years. And so I think it's really hard to keep building a local scene when you're reliant on headliners, you're reliant on lineups, you're reliant on flyers, you know, you're reliant on all of these things, because it's really taken away, I think, from the art of just building a really beautiful space for music to coexist, no matter what it is, in the trust of the club owner. And I'm really, really looking forward. I mean, I tour a lot globally, and I have seen, I'd say, like, specifically right now in like South America and sort of Central America, there is kind of this vibe is still kind of present, where you've got these venues that operate every week, where they've just got a built-in community that goes every week, regardless of who's playing. And I have seen a few of these places, and it's just so nice, because that's kind of how I grew up, was going to clubs. I never knew who was playing. You know, it was just, it's a Friday night. I love this club. The vibe is amazing. And then I'd go in and I'd love the music. And then I'd look at it and I'd be like, oh, sick, this is a new DJ. Like, let me go figure more out about them, you know, follow their resident advisor, like read up about them. Back then there was an Instagram, but you know, it was, there wasn't Spotify either. So, you know, it was just like, okay, we're going to go and like find out where we can listen to their music, you know?
Yeah, totally. Totally. It's interesting that you mentioned South America and Central America. I haven't played there since before the pandemic, actually. So, can you give us a little bit more specific detail about that? Where is particularly good?
I've just come back from spending quite a bit of time in Brazil, and I'm really blown away by the culture in Brazil. And Mexico. I would say like those two countries for me have just really struck home. I feel like particularly in Brazil, you've got such an incredible love of music and dancing, and just, you know, music is life in Brazil. People really grow up with it from the moment they open their eyes, and you really feel it. And people are so open-minded to everything, you know, like when I just played there for Carnival, and you can take people anywhere and they'll just go with you and dance and just give you back what you're giving, you know? And it's such an amazing exchange of the dance floor and the DJ space that, you know, I find sometimes hard finding in other places. And people really, like, even if they've never seen you play, even if they've just heard about you, they'll go, you know, they want to check it out. They're like, oh yeah, I've heard she's good. Like, let's go, you know? They don't need to be proven by anyone else that you're good. You know, I think you have more, people are more open-minded. I think there's specific clubs and venues that have built-in followings, or certain festivals that just consistently have incredible lineups. And so, you know, the fans trust them. They're like, right, you know, there's a specific bar that just opened called Caracol, which has been going for a while, but they just changed venues. And it's just an incredible sort of listening bar that has a proper sound system that goes till about 4 o'clock on the weekends, and they just book incredible artists, from local artists to international artists. And you know, you walk in and people are just there. It doesn't matter what you're playing, they're just there and they're listening and they're dancing. It's like, it's just, I feel like it's places like that are definitely missing a little bit more in the world.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that sounds great.
I love spending time there because it's really inspiring. I also feel musically people there really push the boundaries on, you know, how they sonically build their sets into bringing in a lot of traditional sort of Brazilian groove and rhythm, but also with influences from other places in the world. It's similar to Mexico. You know, there's clubs there that every week are just packed, and you go in and there's so many people I don't know, but no one knows, but you go in and every time the music is just incredible and people go to discover you, you know? And I've been playing in Mexico now for years, and every time I go, I always still get people like, what's your name? You know, like, we love this club. We come here every week, but like, you know, we really want to get to know you more. How can we follow you? How can we find you? You know, it's that kind of feeling where you're like, oh wait, you just came here to like discover a new artist. That's cool.
Yeah. I feel like the art of club booking has sort of declined somewhat, you know, because that's what that is basically. It's people trusting the booker to put on good music, right? And showing up almost regardless, you know, if he's playing. And like you said, like, there are a few venues around the world that still have that kind of pull with their local audience, but definitely not as many as they used to be, right?
100%. 100%. Definitely, it's definitely changed since I started raving. It's when you find those clubs like that, it's really special, I think.
Mm. Yeah, totally. Okay, so you said that you're from New York, but actually I read that you grew up in Paris, but you also spent quite a lot of time in Bristol. Is that right?
Yeah, so people again tend to mix it up because I think I've got quite a complicated background.
Yeah, I got that impression, yeah.
but I was actually born and raised in New York, and I spent most of my life in New York City. I lived in Paris when I was a teenager for about 5 years, for like 11 to 15. And then I moved to Bristol to do my A-levels.
Right. Yeah. In fact, I read that you, did you get kicked out of school? Is that right?
Yeah.
Nice. Yeah. Nice.
Yeah. I got kicked out of a couple schools. And then I sort of ended up in Bristol, got kicked out of that school in Bristol. And then I actually ended up in the countryside in Somerset at a music school, where I basically, I'd always kind of like, I've been playing piano since I'm about, you know, I'd say 5 I started, but 7 was really when I kind of dove into it. And, you know, I was always in Paris, I was playing in bands, and in Bristol, I was doing music, but it's kind of when I went to music.
Hang on, let me interrupt you there. What did you play in bands when you were in bands?
I played piano and guitar.
Really? Okay. Yeah, nice.
Yeah, it was sort of like a funky pianist that played a lot of blues.
Okay, nice. Yeah, cool.
Blues rock, like that kind of sort of progressive rock, that kind of vibe.
So just to place this in time, what year did you move to Bristol?
Okay, so I was born in 92. So I was about 15 when I moved to Bristol. So that would be 2002, so 2007.
Okay.
And at that time, I was coming from a pretty Parisian musical taste of a lot more, I'd say, just rock and roll and house, you know, sort of French house, sort of Ed Banger.
Right, yeah, okay. I was going to say, what kind of French house? So that kind of French house.
Yeah, like I'd say like, you know, like Ed Banger was kind of really starting to make waves in my community. And Social Club was just opening up and we were just kind of starting to listen to Brodinski, to DJ Medi, Breakbot, the Bloody Beetroots, Justice. Yeah, it was a real kind of first time of hearing those kind of sounds, at least in my scope, you know?
Sure, yeah. I actually went to university in Bristol.
Oh, no way.
But it was a few years before you were there.
Okay.
So slightly different, yeah, musical backdrop to it. But
interesting.
I mean, Bristol's obviously a great music town historically, you know?
Yeah, I mean, you know what? When I moved to Bristol, I knew nothing about it. Like, I was so upset. I was like, I don't want to leave Paris. I don't want to go to Bristol. Like, what is Bristol?
Oh, shit.
And I was
packed off to school in the UK?
You know, like
happened?
15, coming. I was playing in a band in Paris. Like, I was partying every night. I was a bit of a rebel. Like, had my crew. And then all of a sudden, I was in Bristol. And I was like, what is going on? But then I arrived in Bristol and I met a bunch of really cool local guys and girls who suddenly educated me on the music scene in Bristol. And I was like, what the hell? Like, I knew nothing about this. This is amazing.
Yeah.
And I just started raving and going out to Lakota, to Motion, to Thecla. And then I got into the proper British rave scene, which is a whole other level of partying.
what kind of music were you into at this point?
It was obviously all dubstep and drum and bass.
Okay.
I was going to and garage. I'd say garage as well, but I was going to Lakota. I think my first night at Lakota, I walked in. And I never heard dubstep in my life. And I walk in and my friends were like, okay, let's do this. And you had to go through metal detector and like, you know, you went into Lakota and, you know, they gave me like an ecstasy and I was like, okay, this is great. I'm like 16 and in Bristol, you know, and then next thing I know, I think Rusko was playing.
All right, okay.
And then it was like Scream and then like, all the like, then it was Dub Police, it was Casper. It was just like, I was just like, what is going on in here? And then upstairs in the little room was this sort of like drum and bass room. And I remember just being immersed in this club with the sounds. And I was like, this is fucking amazing. And everyone was just raving. And I was like, I've never experienced that, you know, like a big warehouse rave. That was like my first like warehouse rave experience.
Right. Yeah, that's something you tend to remember, right? That kind of first experience.
It was incredible. It was just like, you know, what happened? And I kind of went home and I was like, that was mental. Like, wow. And then I just kind of got addicted to going out and listening to all this music. And, you know, I'd go listen to bands at Thecla, all the sort of up and coming indie bands that were coming through Bristol. And then I'd go out, look at like, you know, listen to my rave music. And it was just, Bristol was a really important moment, I think, in my life.
Yeah. I mean, you've just listed like some great venues there, but I mean, yeah, like I said, the kind of heritage of the place goes back a long way. And those things, I think, they stick around, don't they? You know, even when the music scenes change, when a place has got that kind of musical backdrop, it just sort of maintains, you know, and kind of like gets transplanted to whatever new music is coming through. I mean, that era of dubstep was, I mean, I remember, yeah, you know, I was a part of it myself and it was, yeah, it was great. It was so exciting.
Yeah, it was, it just felt very fresh, I think. I think also when you're younger, like all these sounds are so fresh. because everything's new. You know, now I feel like I've heard a lot of different kinds of music. So when I hear something new, I'm like, wow. But back then everything was new. And yeah, I just remember. And then obviously your taste gets refined and then you find your niche. And then, you know, I was then more into liquid drum and bass. And then obviously UK house kind of came in and like, you know, garage. And, you know, it just evolves. But the UK, I think, is just such an incredible, incredible country for electronic music. And it has been for a long, long, long time. So I think I definitely draw a lot of my musical taste and inspiration from there.
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess it's characterized by the different cities and their own individual identities. And Bristol absolutely is one of those, you know, and has a really strong musical identity. So, yeah, tell me about getting moved out to Somerset then. What happened there?
Well, I was at school, boarding school, and my dad was living in the city in Bristol, so I would kind of go home, but I was half boarding and half not, or, you know, whatever, and they kind of found some weed on me, and it was a whole problem, and because I was a new kid, they didn't really like me. They actually kicked me out right away on the spot, told me you can never come back to school, and I was like, This is crazy. I just came here. It's been 6 months and I love Bristol. I've got so many friends at school. So my parents, like, actually basically locked me in the house for 6 months and told me, right, we're going to completely sort of refresh your life. And they kind of forced me to kind of get a structure in place. And that's when I got really into sort of playing piano and guitar. At that point, I joined a couple of bands in Bristol. We were doing some gigs around, but it was already controlled by my parents. You know, they were like drug testing me and it was like a whole,
wow, really?
It was like a pretty, pretty intense environment, but it was great because I just suddenly got really into my creative space. And then I applied to this music school in Somerset and they accepted me. And, you know, I ended up going there and it was amazing because I was part of the jazz sort of section. It was a conservatory and, you know, every morning we'd have to be up at 7 a.m. We'd have to be practicing. And then there was like, you know, I did a music production A-level. I was doing jazz lessons the whole time. A lot of my friends were all musicians. So, you know, I was in the more contemporary side. There was a classical conservatory and a contemporary side, but it was really amazing to be surrounded by so many artists and musicians. Like one of our school projects was to go record a song at Real World Studios, you know, which is obviously like a legendary studio. So I just kind of dove in deep into that moment, into music. And it was part of my curriculum and I was being graded for it. So I was like, this is cool, you know. And then Glastonbury Festival was right next to my school. So I started going there. And so they're kind of, I kind of started to be like, all right, maybe I could work in music. Like, maybe this is real.
Right.
Yeah, maybe yeah. This is a job. Because up until then, it was definitely not feasible.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Was piano your main instrument?
Yeah, piano's been my main instrument for forever.
Yeah, yeah, okay. All right then. So, yeah, thinking about it in the context of a potential, I guess, professional careers, it's a different thing, isn't it? It really is. Certainly what I found is that as soon as it became, you know, a viable possibility, I find that really quite liberating. It was like, wow, I don't have to, I don't have to be part of this fucking world of work that I hate so much. Do you know what I mean? Was it sort of like that for you at all? Or because it sounds like you had a pretty difficult relationship with school and academic institutions up to that point.
Yeah, I mean, I think for me, it was definitely a moment where, you know, when I was a kid and I told my parents, I want to work in music, they were like, no, you need to do something that's actually going to make you money and like be a career. And I was like, no, I love music. They were like, yeah, cute. But like, what do you actually want to do? And I think they slowly realized over the years that like, no matter what, music would be a part of my life, because I was just such a music lover and fan. And, you know, there wasn't a day that went by without music blasting from my room. So I think that, you know, at first my parents, you know, I kind of got into my mind that I wanted to work on the business side. So eventually when I went on to uni, I actually studied music business and went on to working at a label and went on to managing artists and starting an agency and kind of being fully immersed in that whilst always having a creative sort of outcome. But I realized, you know, from meeting a lot of people that you can make money working in music. You know, it's a business. The music business is a pretty...
Yeah, literally.
It's a pretty, you know, it's a business that does bring a lot of money. And when you find your feet in it and you find the right position in it, whether you're on the artist side or the business side, it's a pretty incredible industry to be a part of. You know, I think you feel pretty, you know, there's moments in it that you live through that you don't live through in many other careers. And I'd say in many other industries. And for people that love music, you know, being a part of it is just, it's amazing. Obviously it has its downfalls. But
you know, yeah, there are pros and cons for sure.
But you know, I think we're all a part of it because fundamentally we're all music fans. And I think that for me was a real relief when I was able to be like, right, I can, whatever it is, I'm going to have music in my life forever. You know, this is great.
So, you went to uni in New York though. Is that right?
I did. So I ended up basically, I first went to uni in Boston, but I didn't really like the uni I was in. And I transferred to uni in New York about a year in, after also doing like a really long internship in New York at Universal Music. And I basically transferred to NYU in New York and ended up working straight off the bat at the label and just kind of finished my studies whilst working full time pretty much alongside of that. And at that time, I was also throwing parties in New York and playing in a band. So I was really involved in the sort of nightlife space in New York and the sort of music space. And I was obviously finishing my studies, which my parents, you know, made me swear that I would get my degree.
Right. So what was it like going back to New York? Because I mean, I presume you, having grown up there, I presume you'd been going back to visit regularly. Is that right?
I mean, from time to time, like I would go back when I could, to, you know, I still had a lot of family living there. So like I would try and go see my family, but because I'm French, you know, a lot of my, I was going back to France a lot from the UK.
Sure.
Because my mom was living there, my siblings. So, you know, my dad was in the UK. So I wasn't really spending that much time in New York, but I was always dreaming of going back. You know, it was always as a kid, like I always wanted to kind of do my studies in New York. It was my dream. Going back there was amazing. You know, New York is one of the best cities in the world. It's crazy how much goes on there in one day. You know, the music scene there is just so diverse. It's a real melting pot of just, I don't know, craziness, which I love and I find very inspiring.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it is a crazy place. So what was the, like, you know, you talked about going to raves in the UK, the, you know, the club scene in the States and, well, I mean, the States is a very broad term, but I mean, New York in particular, it's different, palpably different to the way things work or how raving works, let's put it like that, in the UK. So what was it like getting involved in the nightlife scene there?
I mean, when I got involved in it, it was about 11 years ago. No, wait, I'm older now. Sorry, 12 years ago. And it was really amazing. There were these sort of clubs that were extremely, I'd say, exclusive and hard to get into, where, you know, as soon as you kind of got in past, you know, the door person, you'd go in and there'd be like, you know, an insane amount of mixture and diversity of people behind the doors, you know, from your sort of biker crew to your sort of celebrities to the sort of club kids to the music people to the rockers. You know, it was just like this melting pot again of just people. And a lot of the music, I'd say, wasn't necessarily electronic. A lot of the DJs were playing more open format, but it was a lot of rock music. It was a lot of sort of, at the time, it was a lot of the DFA Records artists. So you'd hear a lot of LCD Sound System in the club, the Rapture. You know, it was just a real kind of more uplifting, dancey songs that you could dance to and sing to. And then that was like one side that was going on, sort of Manhattan, downtown. And then you had this whole other side that was Brooklyn, that I was also involved in doing the door for parties, warehouses in Brooklyn. So I do the door for a lot of the after hours. And so on one hand, I was doing that, like I was a promoter in those clubs in New York, where I was like, you know, in charge of bringing people, helping out with DJ bookings. Like I was kind of involved in these different nights at these clubs. And then on the other hand, I was working in the after hour scene. And the after hour scene in Brooklyn was amazing. It was like, you know, you had you had a couple of people that were running these. You had Resolute that's been going for ages. There was the Secret Sunday, Mr. Sundays guys who were, you know, at the time running a pretty consecutive party. You had the Wolf and Lamb parties. And then you had all these sort of illegal offshoots of that that were going on. And you'd kind of show up at 4 a.m. and they'd go all day Sunday. And the bookings were crazy, you know. Like I remember going to one and Andrew Weatherhall was playing in this like crazy warehouse, deep Brooklyn. And so New York was like this kind of really bubbly scene of both of these things.
Yeah, I mean, I if I can just interrupt you, that kind of semi, just actually straightforwardly illegal kind of like warehouse after hours type thing, I played a few of those parties. I used to play for Black Market Membership.
Oh yeah, of course. I think I saw you play at one of those.
Right. Okay. We had Tamar on the show actually talking about it. And my mind was just blown by those parties. It really was. I didn't think that shit existed anymore, but it was fucking crazy. I enjoyed it so much. It was awesome.
Yeah. I mean, you know, that side of New York is the real ravers, you know, like when I was sort of a part of that, I was part of the Black Market Membership, like, you know, online, I'd get the invites and we'd all go with our friends, you know, we'd find out where the address was and we'd all show up. And it was a really, really amazing time in New York where you still had a lot of these underground things going on and they weren't being monetized so much like today. You know, like today, the warehouse scene in New York is quite expensive to go out to. But back then it was like, you know, you'd show up, be like $20 at the door and you were in, you know, you'd have like a makeshift bar and then like sound system DJ and just a bunch of people just going at it. And
yeah,
that was amazing to do that. And, you know,
that's how it's supposed to be, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, totally. I mean, I've told this story before on the show, but the first time I played for Black Market, they actually had a venue in Manhattan. It was in Soho and they ran it till like 11 in the morning on Sunday. I couldn't believe what was happening. I really couldn't. Like people are like spilling out onto the sidewalk at, you know, in the middle of the morning on a Sunday in Manhattan. Yeah,
there was a couple of those that we used to go to that were, a lot of them were Chinese restaurants that were converted into clubs. And they'd be sort of, you'd go upstairs and they'd be in like the back bit and they'd be like insulated. And then the day it would be a Chinese restaurant, but then come Friday, Saturday, these parties would run till Sunday midday. It's crazy, you know?
Yeah.
And New York really has like some real, real left field places, which is why I love it so much.
Yeah, but I suppose there are certain advantages to having a corrupt police force, right?
I mean, facts.
So when did you start DJing though? Because you haven't mentioned DJing at all yet.
Yeah, so this was I guess this all built into my DJ brain. But I started DJing about 7-8 years ago in New York, just simply because I was involved in all this nightlife stuff. At the time, I was actually working for a band management company. And I was running a little agency doing sort of creative direction. And I was working also at a hotel doing the musical direction and the bookings for this hotel rooftop and in Brooklyn. And my friend was like, you should just book yourself to play. You're the musical director, the booker. You should just DJ. You've got great taste in music. And, you know, you can warm up for everyone that comes through. And I was like, you know, I've been collecting music for years. Like, all right. So I just started kind of doing that. And then because I kind of had a bit of a profile in nightlife and, you know, people knew if they booked me, like, I guess certain like friends of mine would come. So they were like, okay, cool. We'll also book her here. And so I just started getting booked, you know, for these opening warm-up slots. And that just kind of grew and grew and grew. I guess because I'd had such an involvement in nightlife for so many years that I just sort of started getting busy that I had to basically like leave my jobs. I had to leave my agency. I actually got fired from the management job.
Right.
I was terrible at day-to-day management, terrible at it. And I just sort of started getting booked and then I got a manager and, you know, the manager was like, right, kind of have to decide between if you want to do the business or the artist side because you can't do both because you got to go full in and you're young enough where it doesn't matter. And so I called my parents. I was like, you know, hey, mom and dad, like, I'm going to be a DJ. They were like, what? <They're> like, are you mad? Like
of all the things in the music industry you could be.
Like, you're going to be a DJ in New York, like hotels and venues? Like, are you okay? And I was like, yeah. They're like, but you're building such a career on the other side and you're managing and blah, blah, blah. And you have an agency. I was like, yeah, it doesn't make me happy. Like, I just want to give it a shot, you know, like I love DJing. So I just kind of went full on and haven't really looked back, you know. It's probably the hardest decision I made, but probably one of the best decisions I've ever made because I truly feel like DJing is an amazing, amazing thing to do.
I mean, it is. Yeah, absolutely. You can have some amazing experiences DJing. For sure. And I think it's still quite misunderstood, honestly, by people who are not directly involved in it. You know, I think it's I think it's underappreciated generally.
Yeah. I mean, it's a very weird job, you know, like you basically are sitting there playing music to people to dance and get drunk to or do whatever to. And your goal is to make people feel things and move and sort of let go of whatever they're going through or whatever it is, you know, but it's a very interesting job because it has, you know, the idea of a disc jockey has actually been around for a long time, but it's definitely evolved over the years. And I can't remember who I was speaking to the other day. I was speaking to Fatboy Slim and, you know, I just did a couple of tour dates with him and, you know, I kind of asked him how things were when he kind of started. And he was like, you know, us DJs were the weirdos. You know, we were the nerds. Like, we had no friends. We were the ones that, like, spent hours in the record shop just buying music and, like, sitting in the corner. You know, like, we were not the cool kids back then. you know? And, you know, we'd get paid, I don't know, £150, if that, to, like, go. No, he said £50. You know, to go and we'd go up with our record bags on the weekends and, you know, just play these records that we loved. And sometimes the club was empty, sometimes it was full. Like, it was a very, very, very different thing, you know, but we all did it because we loved music and we loved, you know, we were nerds. And then he's like, cut to today, I'm like DJing for tens of thousands of people all over the world. And like, everyone knows my music and I've got this whole visual show and this whole thing and it's crazy. But it was very interesting to kind of get that perspective.
It's a career now, you know, and people see it as a career. Like young people, I think, see it as a career in the same way that they might see, I mean, I was going to say being in a band, but it's not even that, I think. I think it's a bit more defined than that now. Because, I mean, I think being a quote-unquote, you know, pop star, that still seems like a remote possibility, you know, I think for anyone. But I get the impression that people look at DJing as something which is a bit more tangible, for better or for worse. You know, as I've saying that sounds pretty bad, doesn't it? But I mean, I do think people sort of think about it like that now.
Yeah, I mean, I think I get a lot of people messaging me and asking me sort of, you know, how did you get into it? Like, how do you do it? Like, how do you get gigs? How do you, like, how?
Yeah, that's kind of what I mean, right? Yeah, there seems, people think there's a kind of secret unlocking code to it or something.
Yeah, and I kind of tell everyone, I'm like, it's not that easy. It's fucking grind. It's work. It's fucking hard work. Like, I'm so tired after touring. It is not what you see out there, you know? Like, you see a fraction of what it is. You know, you don't see, like, it takes so many hours to get your track selection, to learn about genres, to really dig into it, to buy records, to listen to records, to make your edits, to learn about production, to make the music, to do the mixes. You know, it's a whole fucking thing. And I think kids a lot of times just want the fast, easy way to go in and do it and play the record and get the paycheck. But I think ultimately the ones that I've seen kind of doing it the longest, or are still doing it after so many years, are the ones who are really the fans of the music, who love music, who spend every hour of the day if they can learning more about it, you know, and are truly passionate about it. It's not just an easy way to make money or to get famous, you know. And I think that that's been a lot of what I've seen in the last few years is, you know, when I started DJing, it was literally because I loved music and I could make a little bit of money doing it. It was like, okay, here's an extra. I think I was getting paid like $150 or $200 to DJ a week, you know? And I was like, this is great. I live in New York. I'm broke anyways. This will help me, you know, get by a little bit more. And it's great.
Pay for some records anyway. You know.
Pay some records that I love. And like, I get to make people dance. This is amazing. But it was so far away from my mind of what it is today, you know, and even where I've come today, like I never even imagined that would be what happened.
So yeah, you touched on production there, and you know, from your backstory, obviously you're a music person, like predating any of this stuff. So, I mean, how do you, or how important is production? It must be very important, right? Judging by what you've just been saying for the last hour or so.
I mean, production for me is the most important. I think what was difficult for me stepping into DJing was, well, not difficult, but I mean, not DJing, I'd say into production, was that I come from a songwriting background and a background of melodies. And so when you're obviously stepping into making more dance music, it's more about the groove and the drums. And you know, jazz piano is great, but it's too complex sometimes for electronic music. You know, you're talking about two notes, sometimes three. Bass lines are pretty simple. You know, it's like, it's, you know, you're taking away. So I had to kind of unlearn a lot of what I had learned from theory, from school, to kind of, because, you know, dance music, a lot of my friends who make incredible records have no classical training. They barely know how to play any instruments.
Yeah, this is a fascinating question, actually, and one we have discussed before, notably, actually, when we had MJ Cole on the show. He's obviously a very classically trained person, very good pianist like yourself. And, you know, people have different opinions on this, you know. I think when you ask someone who doesn't know theory, like whether they, you know, wish they did, they almost always say no, which is probably slightly self-serving as a response. but then, you know, I think what you're saying about having to unlearn it, that really makes sense. I mean, I am quite classically trained, but you know, didn't do the degree level or anything like that, like Matt did. So yeah, I think the need to step back from it is obviously there, but then also it can be really useful too, can't it?
Yeah, I mean, I think, like, for example, you know, if I'm for example, when I started DJing, it was very easy for me to understand songs that go together and songs that don't, you know, just in terms of mixing. I was like, oh, that loop works with that loop because that drum groove is in that key and this track is in that key and this lead is in that, you know. It's like you understand how to collage, how you understand how to mix, I think. Similar to making music, you know, when you're building a groove, you understand, okay, this is the relative key to this. This is, you know, this transposition of this chord might give more space for the low end. You know, it's silly things like that which do give you a level up, I think, when you start producing and when you start DJing, because it's not a completely unknown world. You know, the technological aspect is, but the theory behind it is kind of similar to what you've been learning, because it's just music.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
The thing is that you have to unlearn a bit is that, for example, in jazz, when you're playing chords, every finger has to have a purpose. And sometimes, you know, when I first started making music with my collective, Josh Ludlow, who was part of my Public Access duo, you know, he comes from also a very musical background, but not jazz, more rock. So he'd be like, Chloe, just try taking out like three notes and just stick to like two and like create a riff with that. And I was like, yeah, okay, cool. Let's do that. And then I'd do it. I'd be like, that feels weird. And then I'd be like, no, but it's groove. Okay. And then, so, you know, it took me a minute, but then I understood it because also I had played in bands before. So I think, you know, I think, listen, today with the abilities you can in production, you know, I don't even think you need to know how to do anything. I think that there's AI, there's all of these.
I mean, is that a problem? How much of a problem is that, do you think?
I mean, for me, coming from my world, I think it's a problem because I think that the art of creating from scratch doesn't really exist anymore. And I think there's a lot of things that are made very rapidly without a lot of thought. And there's a lot of quantity and not a lot of quality. Obviously, I'm not going to generalize because there's incredible music being made and there's incredible artists and producers out there. But I'd say on a spectrum of what I hear on a day-to-day basis, you can kind of hear what's been made fast by using these sort of AI loops and sample packs and all these kind of things. And people tend to reuse the same loops all the time, so you can hear them. You know, and I think that for me, it's thinking today, like, right, my reality is that I don't have a lot of time in the studio because I'm touring a lot. So how can I utilize both things? You know, how can I still be creative and keep my creative mind and my background of keys and synthesis and piano and melodies and groove with also, okay, if I'm on the road, like, how can I get a quick idea going when I'm on a plane and I've got a 3-hour ride to just get an idea going or make an edit, you know? So it's kind of like, you know, I like the idea of combining everything, but I definitely think that we're heading towards a world of production that's it's very different than what I came from or what I've learned.
Yeah. It's a little bit scary, I think, for a lot of people, myself included. I mean, do you have a view about AI more generally? I mean, we've talked quite a bit on the show in recent episodes about the way that AI models work with learning from existing work. Like, for example, a question I've been asking a lot of people is, how do you feel about your music being used to train AI models?
I mean, it's a very weird question. I think like everything, right? It's like when, for example, the radio came about, like people freaked out, you know, when vinyl moved to cassette, when cassette moved to CD, when CD moved to streaming. Like every time there's a new invention or a new sort of technological breakthrough, like people freak out because they're like, this is the end of everything. And the truth is, it's not. It's the beginning of something new. And I think AI is going to become a platform that's going to be extremely useful. You know, I think, for example, today, like if I'm trying to make an edit, you can put tracks through a software that, you know, allows you to separate stems. So
I've been using one of those recently. That's so good. You know, that's so much
amazing.
Fun. Yeah.
I've been making edits for so long just by like EQing myself the track and like trying to like extract things from it. And now there's like something that does it for you, which is brilliant. So I think that, you know, for it to learn from my music and it to grow, I think it's great. I think why not? You know, I'm not going to be a hater and I'm not going to be someone that's just going to be anti it. I think us producers, it's our role to learn more about it and actually learn about the software and understand how it can help us, you know, because actually production is all about growth and technology too. You know, every year there's new software, there's new synths, there's new plugins, there's new hardware, there's new information on how to make things sound better and different. And I think for me to sit here and be like, oh, that's terrible, would be really counter the world that we live in. And I have a lot of friends who are anti and only about vintage and, you know, all these things. And I love that.
Yes. There's a place for that. But at the same time, it's sort of, I tend to start rolling my eyes quite quickly when there's too much of that sort of thing, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I really love it. You know, like I collect records, you know, I just bought a really nice rotary mixer. Like I'm all about getting quality and quality of sound. And I have a lot of synths and a lot of, you know, fun toys in my studio. But at the same time, it's like, right, the goal is just to make good music. And
exactly. It's what comes out of the speakers, which is the most important
exactly.
thing.
Exactly.
Right?
And I have friends of mine who literally don't own a synthesizer. They don't own one. And you'd listen to their music and you couldn't tell. And a lot of their music is made from samples and editing samples and chopping samples and resampling and all these sort of techniques that are their techniques. And their music sounds great. And then I have friends who are pure hardware guys who have never touched AI, never touched anything, purely, you know, our studio heads, they, you know, they're very deep in it and their music also sounds amazing. So I think there's a space for everyone.
Just, if I can ask the actual question again, though, obviously the way that the kind of current generation, let's put it that way, of AI programs depend upon being trained, right, on data, whether that's books or video or music. And, you know, some people would view the building of a business on the back of that sort of training as being theft, frankly. How do you feel about that in particular?
I think it's a bit, I think there's a huge issue right now with monetizing in AI. And I think for me, the first thing that comes up when you say that is that we really need to figure out intellectual property. Because obviously as artists, we spend a lot of time getting to the stage where we have a song that's out there. And for a software to just come in, use it, learn, and then grow from that, it just definitely feels like theft. So I really hope that in the next few years, I mean, Spotify have been really, you know, there's so many issues today in the streaming world, that I just hope that maybe AI is a way to solve that. And actually to, you know, distribute royalties how they should be. But my fear with all of this stuff is that it's growing so quickly and I don't know how quickly we can create the right framework or rules for these things to be operated. You know, it's super hard to track AI and to figure out kind of where they're learning from what or how it's growing. I mean, you know, that's just kind of how I feel about it. Yeah, it's tricky.
Yeah, it absolutely is tricky. That's certainly the right word. Okay, just a couple more to finish up. What was the best band that you were in?
I was in a really fun band when I was 14 called The Clockworks. That was my first ever band. And I think that was probably one of the most fun bands because it was the first band. And everything was just fresh. It was like, okay, we're going to wear leather jackets and like do these cool band photos and like get in the studio and just play loads of rock music and be angry, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
It just felt so free and fun. And then I feel like a lot of the bands I was in after that, you know, I was more serious. So it was maybe a little less fun, but it was definitely creative in many other ways. Mm.
Yeah. I mean, I had so much fun in bands too. That's why I wanted to ask you that question because you're absolutely right. Particularly when you're a kid, those kind of formative experiences in music are just so, I think they're so valuable, but they're so memorable as well, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I also think like when you're that young, you're not really thinking about like money and career. It's just literally like, I want to go play music with my friends on a Thursday night and like be angry and drink beer and like, you know, like, complain about the world and, you know, it's funny.
Okay, last question. It's a bad one, but give me your top three clubs in the world.
Oof. Wow. Top three clubs in the world. I mean, I just played at Panorama Bar, so I would have to say that Berghain is up there.
It has to be, right?
Yeah. And I literally just played. So it's definitely up there. I would say, no, it's a hard one. Probably DC 10 in Ibiza.
Mm-hmm.
And then let me think. Probably UU in Mexico City.
Okay, I haven't been to that one. Tell me about that.
It's a small, tiny, sweaty room for 70 people. Nice. The sound isn't the best, but it's just the vibe. It's a little tunnel with these little lights. It's so hot in there, but it's just a proper rave. I just played there and I just felt like I was back in the sort of early days of my raving. It was amazing.
Wicked. Sounds great. Well, Chloe, this has been great. Thanks so much for your time. It's been awesome.
Thank you so much. Thank you for chatting and having me on the show.
Yeah, that was Chloe Kaye. What a thoughtful and interesting person. Really enjoyed chatting to her. It was great to get her takes on those questions, like the music theory questions and the AI questions. And also, I guess, the state of the scene questions that we covered a bit earlier on too. It's always interesting to get different people's takes on that sort of stuff. And someone who is as deep in the circuit as she is, well, yeah, I mean, her views are, they're informed opinions, right? So this is the kind of stuff we like on the show. Anyway, as I mentioned, I'm in a hotel room. So just a quick reminder that you can support the show on Patreon, patreon.com/scubaofficial, or via one-off donations on scubaofficial.io/support, including via Ethereum wallets. Join us on the Discord, hotfrostrecordings.com/discord. Follow the Spotify playlist. And you know what? That's about it. I will see you back here, same time, same place next week for the next episode of the Not a Diving Podcast. Thank you.
Summer's just around the corner, so give your body the care it deserves with Osea's best-selling Andaria Algae Body Oil. Created by infusing Andaria seaweed in barrels of botanical oils, it leaves skin silky soft and glowing. Plus, it's clinically proven to improve elasticity and deeply moisturize without feeling greasy. It's safe, clean, vegan skincare. Get 10% off your first order at OseaMalibu.com with code GLOW, plus free shipping on orders over $60.